Penguin Random House Audio presents Wild Cards 4, Aces Abroad. Edited by George R. R. Martin and written by Stephen Lay, John Joseph Miller, Leanne C. Harper, Kevin Andrew Murphy, Gail Gerstner Miller, Walton Simons, Edward Bryant, Louis Shiner, Carrie Vaughn, Victor W. Milan, Melinda M. Snodgrass, Michael Cassett, and George R. R. Martin. Performed by Selma Blair, Clancy Brown, Adrian Paul, Armin Shimmerman, Kathleen Turner, and a full cast. Editor's note: Wild Cards is a work of fiction set in a completely imaginary world whose history parallels our own. Names, characters, places, and incidents depicted in Wild Cards are fictitious or are used fictitiously. Any resemblance to actual events, locales, or real persons, living or dead, is entirely coincidental. The works contained in this anthology are works of fiction. Any writings referred to within these works are themselves fictional, and there is no intent to depict actual writers or to imply that any such persons have ever actually written or published the fictional essays, articles, or other works referred to in the works of fiction comprising this anthology.
The Tint of Hatred by Stephen Lay. Read for you by Clancy Brown, Emily Rankin, and Yasmin Barghouti.
Prologue. Thursday, November 27th, 1986, Washington, D.C. The Sony threw flickering light over Sarah's Thanksgiving feast, a Swanson turkey dinner steaming in foil on the coffee table. On the television screen, a mob of misshapen jokers marched through a sweltering New York summer afternoon, their mouths moving in silent screams and curses. The grainy scene had the jerky look of an old newsreel, and suddenly the picture swung about to show a handsome man in his mid-30s, his sleeves rolled up, his suit coat slung over a shoulder and his tie loose on his neck. Senator Greg Hartman, as he had been in 1976. Hartman strode through the police lines blockading the jokers, shrugging away the security men who tried to hold him, shouting at the police himself. Alone, he stood between the authorities and the oncoming crowd of jokers, motioning them back. Then the camera panned toward a disturbance within the ranks of jokers. The images were jumbled and out of focus. At the center was the ace prostitute known as Succubus, her body seemingly made of quicksilver flesh, her appearance constantly shifting. The wild card had cursed her with sexual empathy. Succubus could take on whatever shape and form most pleased her clients, but that ability was now out of control. Around her, people responded to her power, grasping out for her with a strange lust on their faces. Her mouth was open in an imploring scream as the pursuing crowd, police and jokers both, bore her down. Her arms were stretched out in supplication, and as the camera panned back, there was Hartman again, his jaw open in surprise as he gaped at Succubus. Her arms were reaching for him. Her plea was for him. Then she was gone under the mob. For several seconds, she was buried, lost. But then the crowd drew back in horror. The camera followed Hartman closer. He shoved through those around Succubus, angrily pushed them away. Sarah reached for the VCR's remote switch. She touched the pause button, freezing the scene, a moment of time that had shaped her life. She could feel the hot tears streaking her face. Succubus lay twisted in a pool of blood, her body mangled, her face turned upward as Hartman stared at her, mirroring Sarah's horror. Sarah knew the face that Succubus, whoever she might have really been, had found just before death. Those young features had haunted Sarah since childhood. Succubus had taken on Andrea Whitman's face. Sarah's older sister's face. Andrea, who, at 13, had been brutally murdered in 1950. Sarah knew who had kept that pubescent image of Andrea locked away in his mind for so many years. She knew who had placed Andrea's features on the infinitely malleable body of Succubus. She could imagine that face on Succubus as he lay with her, and that thought hurt Sarah most of all. "You bastard!" Sarah whispered to Senator Hartman, her voice choking. "You goddamn bastard! You killed my sister, and you couldn't even let her stay dead."
From the Journal of Xavier Desmond, by George R. R. Martin. Read for you by Armin Shimmerman. November 30th, Jokertown. My name is Xavier Desmond, and I am a joker. Jokers are always strangers, even on the street where they were born, and this one is about to visit a number of strange lands. In the next 5 months, I will see Veldts and mountains, Rio and Cairo, the Khyber Pass and the Straits of Gibraltar, the Outback and the Champs-Élysées, all very far from home for a man who has often been called the mayor of Jokertown. Jokertown, of course, has no mayor. It is a neighborhood, a ghetto neighborhood at that, and not a city. Jokertown is more than a place, though. It's a condition, a state of mind. Perhaps, in that sense, my title is not undeserved. I have been a joker since the beginning. 40 years ago, when Jet Boy died in the skies over Manhattan and loosed the wild card upon the world, I was 29 years of age, an investment banker with a lovely wife, a 2-year-old daughter, and a bright future ahead of me. A month later, when I was finally released from the hospital, I was a monstrosity with a pink elephantine trunk growing from the center of my face where my nose had been. There are 7 perfectly functional fingers at the end of my trunk, and, over the years, I have become quite adept with this third hand. Were I suddenly restored to so-called normal humanity, I believe it would be as traumatic as if one of my limbs were amputated. With my trunk, I am ironically somewhat more than human, and infinitely less. My lovely wife left me within 2 weeks of my release from the hospital, at approximately the same time the Chase Manhattan informed me that my services would no longer be required. I moved to Jokertown 9 months later, following my eviction from my Riverside Drive apartment for health reasons. I last saw my daughter in 1948. She was married in June of 1964, divorced in 1969, remarried in June of 1972. She has a fondness for June weddings, it seems. I was invited to neither of them. The private detective I hired informs me that she and her husband now live in Salem, Oregon, and that I have 2 grandchildren, a boy and a girl, 1 from each marriage. I sincerely doubt that either knows that their grandfather is the mayor of Jokertown. I am the founder and president emeritus of the Joker's Anti-Defamation League, or JADL, the oldest and largest organization dedicated to the preservation of civil rights for the victims of the wild card virus. The JADL has had its failures, but overall, it has accomplished great good. I am also a moderately successful businessman. I own one of New York's most storied and elegant nightclubs, the Funhouse, where jokers and gnats and aces have enjoyed all the top joker cabaret acts for more than 2 decades. The Funhouse has been losing money steadily for the last 5 years, but no one knows that except me and my accountant. I keep it open because it is, after all, the Funhouse, and were it to close, Jokertown would seem a poorer place. Next month, I will be 70 years of age. My doctor tells me that I will not live to be 71. The cancer had already metastasized before it was diagnosed. Even jokers cling stubbornly to life, and I've been doing the chemotherapy and the radiation treatments for half a year now. But the cancer shows no sign of remission. My doctor tells me the trip I'm about to embark on will probably take months off my life. I have my prescriptions and will dutifully continue to take the pills, but when one is globe-hopping, radiation therapy must be foregone. I have accepted this. Mary and I often talked of a trip around the world in those days before the wild card, when we were young and in love. I could never have dreamt that I would finally take that trip without her, in the twilight of my life and at government expense, as a delegate on a fact-finding mission organized and funded by the Senate Committee on ACE Resources and Endeavors, under the official sponsorship of the United Nations and the World Health Organization. We will visit every continent but Antarctica and call upon 39 different countries, some only for a few hours. And our official charge is to investigate the treatment of wildcard victims in cultures around the world. There are 21 delegates, only 5 of whom are jokers. I suppose my selection is a great honor, recognition of my achievements and my status as a community leader. I believe I have my good friend Dr. Tachyon to thank for it. But then, I have my good friend Dr. Tachyon to thank for a great many things.
The Tint of Hatred, Part 1. Monday, December 1st, 1986, Syria. A chill, arid wind blew from the mountains of the Jebel el-Wait across the lava rock and gravel desert of Bidayat al-Sham. The wind snapped the canvas peaks of the tents huddled around the village. The gale made those in the market pull the sashes of their robes tighter against the cold. Under the beehive roof of the largest of the mud-brick buildings, a stray gust caused the flame to gutter against the bottom of an enameled teapot. A small woman, swathed in a chador, the black Islamic garb, poured tea into 2 small cups. Except for a row of bright blue beads on the headpiece, she wore no ornamentation. She passed one of the cups to the other person in the room, a raven-haired man of medium height, whose skin glowed a shimmering, lambent emerald under a brocaded robe of azure. She could feel the warmth radiating from him. "It will be colder for the next several days, Najib," she said as she sipped the piercingly sweet tea. "You'll be more comfortable at least." Najib shrugged as if her words meant nothing. His lips tightened. His dark, intense gaze snared her. "It's Allah's presence that gleams," he said, his voice gruff with habitual arrogance. "You've never heard me complain, Misha, even in the heat of summer. Do you think me a woman, wailing my futile misery to the sky?" Above the veils, Misha's eyes narrowed. "I am Kahina, the seer, Najib," she answered, allowing a hint of defiance into her voice. "I know many hidden things. I know that when the heat ripples over the stones, my brother Najib wishes that you are not Nur Allah, the light of Allah." Najib's sudden backhanded cuff caught his sister across the side of her face. Her head snapped sideways. Scalding hot tea burned her hand and wrist. The cup shattered on the rugs as she sprawled at his feet. His eyes, utter black against the luminescent face, glared at her as she raised her hand to her stinging cheek. She knew she dared say no more. On her knees, she gathered up the shards of the teacup in silence, mopping at the puddle of tea with the hem of her robe.
"Saeed came to me this morning," Najib said as he watched her. "He was complaining again. He says you are not a proper wife."
"Saeed is a fatted pig,"
Misha answered, though she did not look up.
He says he must force himself on you.
He doesn't need to do so for me. Najib scowled, making a sound of disgust.
Pah! Sayid leads my army. It is his strategy that will sweep the kafir back into the sea. Allah has given him the body of a god and the mind of a conqueror, and he is obedient to me. That's why I gave you to him. The Quran says it. Men have authority over women because Allah has made the one superior to the other. Good women are obedient. You make a mockery of Nur Allah's gift.
Nur Allah shouldn't have given away that which completes him. Now her eyes came up, challenging him as her tiny hands closed over the pottery shards. We were together in the womb, brother. That's the way Allah made us. He touched you with his light and his voice, and he gave me the gift of his sight. You are his mouth, the prophet. I am your vision of the future. Don't be so foolish as to blind yourself. Your pride will defeat you.
Then listen to the words of Allah and be humble. Be glad that Sayid does not insist on purda for you. He knows your kahina, so he doesn't force your seclusion. Our father should never have sent you to Damascus to be educated. The infection of the unbelievers is insidious. Misha, make Sayid content because that will content me. My will is Allah's will.
Only sometimes, brother. She paused. Her gaze went distant, her fingers clenched. She cried out as porcelain lacerated her palm. Blood drooled bright along the shallow cuts. Misha swayed, moaning, and then her gaze focused once more. Najib moved a step closer to her.
What is it? What did you see?
Misha cradled her injured hand to her breast, her pupils wide with pain. All that ever matters is that which touches yourself, Najib. It doesn't matter that I hurt or that I hate my husband or that Najib and his sister Misha have been lost in Allah's roles for them. All that matters is what the kahina can tell Nur Allah.
Woman,
Najib began warningly. His voice had a compelling deepness now, a timbre that brought Misha's head up and made her open her mouth to begin to speak, to obey without thinking. She shivered as if the wind outside had touched her. Don't use the gift on me, Najib, she said, gratingly. Her voice sounded harsh against that of her brother. I am not a supplicant. Compel me too often with Allah's tongue, and you might one day find that Allah's eyes have been taken from you by my own hand.
Then be kahina, sister,
Najib answered, but it was only his own voice now. He watched as she went to an inlaid chest, took out a strip of cloth, and slowly wrapped her hand.
Tell me what you just saw. Was it the vision of the jihad? Did you see me holding the caliph's scepter again?
Misha shut her eyes, bringing back the image of the quick waking dream.
No,
she told him.
This was new. In the distance I saw a falcon against the sun. As the bird flew closer, I noticed that it held 100 people squirming in its talons. A giant stood below on a mountain, and the giant held a bow in his hands. He loosed an arrow at the bird, and the wounded falcon screamed in anger. The voices of those it held screamed also. The giant had knocked a second arrow, but now the bow began to twist in his hands, and the arrow instead struck the giant's own breast. I saw the giant fall. Misha's eyes opened. That's all. Najib scowled. He passed a glowing hand over his eyes.
What does it mean?
I don't know what it means. Allah gives me the dreams, but not always the understanding. Perhaps the giant is Sayid.
It was only your own dream, not Allah's.
Najib stalked away from her, and she knew that he was angry.
I'm the falcon holding the faithful, he said. You are the giant, large because you belong to Sayid, who is also large. Allah would remind you of the consequence of defiance.
He faced away from Misha, closing the shutters of the window against the brilliant desert sun. Outside, the muezzin called from the village mosque.
Ashhadu al ilaha illallah.
Allah is great. I bear witness that there is no God but Allah. All you want is your conquest, the dream of the jihad. You want to be the new Muhammad, Misha answered spitefully. You won't accept any other interpretation.
Insha'Allah,
Najib answered, if Allah wills. He refused to face her.
Some people Allah has visited with his dreadful scourge, showing their sins with their rotting, twisted flesh. Others, like Zaid, Allah has favored, gifting them. Each has been given his due. He has chosen me to lead the faithful. I only do what I must do. I have Zaid, who guides my armies, and I fight also with the hidden ones like the Al-Muazzin. You lead too. You are Kahina, and you are also Fqahas, the one the women look to for guidance.
The light of Allah turned back into the room. In the shuttered dimness, he was a spectral presence.
And as I do Allah's will, you must do mine.
Monday, December 1st, 1986, New York. The press reception was chaos. Senator Greg Hartman finally escaped to an empty corner behind one of the Christmas trees, his wife, Ellen, and his aide, John Worthen, following. Greg surveyed the room with a distinct frown. He shook his head toward the Justice Department ace Billy Ray, Carnifex, and the government security man who tried to join them, waving them back. Greg had spent the last hour fending off reporters, smiling blankly for video cameras, and blinking into the constant storm lightning of electronic flashes. The room was noisy with shouted questions and the click whir of high-speed Nikons. Muzak played seasonal tunes over the ceiling speakers. The main press contingent was now gathered around Dr. Takyan, Chrysalis, and Peregrine. Takyan's scarlet hair gleamed like a beacon in the crowd. Peregrine and Chrysalis seemed to be competing to see who could pose most provocatively for the cameras. Nearby, Jack Braun, Golden Boy, the Judas Ace, was being pointedly ignored. The mob had thinned a bit since Hiram Worcester's staff from the Aces High had set up the buffet tables. Some of the press had staked permanent claims around the well-freighted trays. Sorry, boss, John said at Greg's elbow. Even in the cool room, the aide was perspiring. Blinking Christmas lights reflected from his beaded forehead, red, then blue, then green. Somebody on the airport staff dropped the ball. It wasn't supposed to be this kind of free-for-all. I told him I wanted the press escorted in after you guys were settled. They'd ask a few questions, then... He shrugged. I'll take the blame. I should have checked to make sure everything had been done. Ellen gave John a withering glance, but said nothing. If John's apologizing, make him grovel first, Senator. What a mess. That last was a whisper in Greg's ear. His other longtime aide, Amy Sorensen, was circulating through the crowd as one of the security personnel. Her two-way radio was linked directly to a wireless receiver in Greg's ear. She fed him information, gave him names or details concerning the people he met. Greg's own memory for names and faces was quite good, but Amy was an excellent backup. Between the two of them, Greg rarely missed giving those around him a personal greeting. John's fear of Greg's anger was a bright, pulsing purple amidst the jumble of his emotions. Greg could feel Ellen's placid, dull acceptance colored slightly with annoyance. It's okay, John, Greg said softly, though underneath he was seething. That part of him that he thought of as the puppet man squirmed restlessly, begging to be let loose to play with the cascading emotions in the room. Half of them are our puppets, controllable. Look, there's Father Squid over near the door trying to get away from that woman reporter. Feel his scarlet distress even as he's smiling. He'd love to slither away, and he's too polite to do it. We could fuel that frustration into rage, make him curse the woman. We could feed on that. All it would take is the smallest nudge. But Greg couldn't do that. Not with the aces gathered here, the ones Greg didn't dare take as puppets because they had mental abilities of their own, or because he simply felt the prospect too risky. Golden Boy, Fantasy, Mistral, Chrysalis, and the one he feared most of all, Takyan. If they even had an inkling of Puppet Man's existence, if they knew what I've done to feed him, Tachyon would have them on me in a pack the way he did with the Masons. Greg took a deep breath. The corner smelled overbearingly of pine. Thanks, boss, John was saying. Already his lilac fear was receding. Across the room, Greg saw Father Squid finally disengage himself from the reporter and shamble pitifully toward Hiram's buffet on his tentacles. The reporter saw Greg at the same moment and gave him a strange, piercing glance. She strode toward him. Amy had seen the movement as well.
Sarah Morgenstern, Post correspondent, she whispered in Greg's ear. Pulitzer 76 for her work on the Great Jokertown Riot, co-wrote the nasty article on Scare in July's Newsweek. Just had a makeover, too. Looks totally different.
Amy's warning startled Greg. He hadn't recognized her. Greg remembered the article. It had stopped just short of libel, intimating that Greg and the Scare aces had been involved in government suppression of facts concerning the Swarm Mother attack. He remembered Morgenstern from various press functions, always the one with the hardball questions, with a sharp edge to her voice. He might have taken her for a puppet just for spite, but she had never come close to him. Whenever they had been at the same affairs, she stayed well away. Now, seeing her approach, he froze for an instant. She had indeed changed. Sarah had always been slim, boyish. That was accentuated tonight. She wore tight black slacks and a clinging blouse. She dyed her hair blonde, and her makeup accentuated her cheekbones and large, faintly blue eyes. She looked distressingly familiar. Greg was suddenly cold and afraid. Inside, Puppet Man howled at a remembered loss.
Greg, are you all right?
Ellen's hand touched his shoulder. Greg shivered at his spouse's touch, shaking his head. I'm fine, he said brusquely. He put on his professional smile, moving out from the corner. Alongside him, Ellen and John flanked him in practiced choreography. Miss Morgenstern, Greg said warmly, extending his hand and forcing his voice into a calmness he didn't feel. I think you know John, but my wife, Ellen? Sarah Morgenstern nodded perfunctorily toward Ellen, but her gaze stayed with Greg. She had an odd, strained smile on her face that seemed half challenge and half invitation.
Senator, she said, I hope you're looking forward to this trip as much as I am.
She took his proffered hand. Without volition, Puppet Man used the moment of contact. As he had done with every new puppet, he traced the neural pathways back to the brain, opening the doors that would later allow him access from a distance. He found the locked gates of her emotions, the turbulent colors swirling behind, and he greedily, possessively touched them. He unfastened the locks and pins, swung open the entrance. The red-black loathing that spilled out from behind sent him reeling back. The abhorrence was directed toward him. All of it. Totally unexpected. The fury of the emotion was like nothing he'd experienced. Its intensity threatened to drown him. It drove him back. Puppet Man gasped. Greg forced himself to show nothing. He let his hand drop as Puppet Man moaned in his head, and the fear that had touched him a moment ago redoubled. She looks like Andrea, like Succubus. The resemblance is startling. And she detests me. God, how she hates.
Senator? Sarah repeated.
Yes, I'm very much looking forward to this, he said automatically. Our society's attitudes towards the victims of the wildcard virus have changed for the worse in the last year. In some ways, people like the Reverend Leo Barnett would have us regress to the oppression of the 50s. For less enlightened countries, the situation is far, far worse. We can offer them understanding, hope, and help, and we'll learn something ourselves. Dr. Tachyon and myself have great optimism for this trip, or we wouldn't have fought so hard to bring it about. The words came with rehearsed smoothness while he recovered. He could hear the friendly casualness of his voice, felt his mouth pull into a proud half-smile. But none of it touched him. He could barely avoid staring rudely at Sarah, at this woman, who reminded him too much of Andrea Whitman, of Succubus. I loved her. I couldn't save her. Sarah seemed to sense his fascination, for she cocked her head with that same odd challenge. It's also an entertaining little junket. A 3-month tour of the world at the taxpayer's expense. Your wife goes with you, your good friends like Dr. Tachyon and Hiram Worcester. At his side, Greg felt Ellen's irritation. She was too practiced a politician's wife to respond, but he could feel her sudden alertness, a jungle cat watching for a weakness in her prey. Off balance, Greg frowned a moment too late. I'm surprised a reporter of your experience would believe that, Miss Morgenstern. This trip also means giving up the holiday season. Normally, I go home after the congressional break. It means stops at places that aren't exactly on photo's recommended list. It means meetings, briefings, endless press conferences, and a ton of paperwork that I can certainly do without. I guarantee you this isn't a pleasure trip. I'll have more to do than watch the proceedings and cable 1,000 words back home every day. He felt the black hatred swelling in her, and the power in him ached to be used. Let me take her. Let me dampen that fire. Take away that hatred, and she'll tell you what she knows. Disarm her. She's yours, he answered. Puppet Man leapt out. Greg had encountered hatreds before, 100 times, but none had ever been focused on him. He found control of the emotion, elusive and slippery. Her loathing pushed at his control like a palpable living entity driving Puppet Man back. What the hell is she hiding? What caused this? You sound offensive, Senator, Sarah said. Still, a reporter can't help but think that the main purpose of the trip, especially for a potential 88 presidential candidate, might be to finally erase the memories of a decade ago. Greg could not help the intake of breath. Andrea, succubus. Sarah grinned, a predator smile. He readied himself to assault her hatred again. I'd say that Great Joker Town riot obsesses both of us, Senator, she continued, her voice deceivingly light. I know it did when I wrote my piece on it, and your behavior after Succubus's death cost you the Democratic nomination that year. After all, she was only a whore, wasn't she, Senator? And not worth your little breakdown. The reminder made him flush. I'll wager we've both thought about that moment every day since then, Sarah continued. It's been 10 years now, and I still remember.
Puppet Man wailed, retreating. Greg was startled into silence. My God, what does she know? What is she hinting at?
He had no time to formulate a reply. Amy's voice spoke in his ear again.
Digger Downs is heading over at a trot, Senator. He's with Aces Magazine, covers the entertainment types, a real sleazeball, if you ask me. Guess he saw Morgenstern and figured he'd listen in to a good reporter.
Hiya, folks,
Downs' voice intruded before Amy had finished speaking. Greg looked momentarily away from Sarah to see a short, pallid young man. Downs fidgeted nervously, sniffing as if he had a head cold.
Mind another reporter's nosing in, Sarah Love?
Downs was a maddening interruption, his manner rude and falsely familiar. He seemed to sense Greg's turmoil. He grinned and looked from Sarah to Greg, ignoring Ellen and John.
I think I've said all I want to, for the moment, Sarah answered.
Her pale aqua eyes were still locked on Greg's. Her face seemed childlike with feigned innocence. Then, with a lithe turn, she spun away from him, going toward Tachyon. Greg stared after her.
Chick's looking damn good these days, ain't she, Senator?
Downs grinned again.
Begging your pardon, of course, Mrs. Hartman. Hey, let me introduce myself. I'm Digger Downs with Aces Magazine, and I'll be tagging along on this little venture. We'll be seeing a lot of each other.
Greg, watching Sarah disappear into the crowd around Tachyon, realized that Downs was staring at him strangely. With an effort, he forced his attention away from Sarah. Pleased to meet you, he said to Downs. His smile felt wooden. It made his cheeks ache.
From the Journal of Xavier Desmond. December 1st, New York City. The journey is off to an inauspicious start. For the last hour, we've been holding on the runway at Tomlin International, waiting for clearance for takeoff. The problem, we are informed, is not here, but down in Havana. So, we wait. Our plane is a custom 747 that the press has dubbed the stacked deck. The entire central cabin has been converted to our requirements. The seats replaced with a small medical laboratory, a press room for the print journalists, and a miniature television studio for their electronic counterparts. The newsmen themselves have been segregated in the tail. Already, they've made it their own. I was back there 20 minutes ago and found a poker game in progress. The business class cabin is full of aides, assistants, secretaries, publicists, and security personnel. First class is supposedly reserved exclusively for the delegates. As there are only 21 delegates, we rattle around like peas in a pod. Even here, the ghettos persist. Jokers tend to sit with jokers, gnats with gnats, aces with aces. Hartman is the only man aboard who seems entirely comfortable with all three groups. He greeted me warmly at the press conference and sat with Howard and myself for a few moments after boarding, talking earnestly about his hopes for the trip. It is difficult not to like the senator. Jokerton has delivered him huge majorities in each of his campaigns as far back as his term as mayor, and no wonder. No other politician has worked so long and hard to defend Joker's rights. Hartman gives me hope. He's living proof that there can indeed be trust and mutual respect between Joker and Nat. He's a decent, honorable man. And in these days when fanatics such as Leo Barnett are inflaming the old hatreds and prejudices, Jokers need all the friends they can get in the halls of power. Dr. Tachyon and Senator Hartman co-chair the delegation. Tachyon arrived dressed like a foreign correspondent from some film noir classic, in a trench coat covered with belts, buttons, and epaulettes, a snap-brim fedora rakishly tilted to one side. The fedora sports a foot-long red feather, however, and I cannot begin to imagine where one goes to purchase a powder-blue, crushed velvet trench coat. A pity that those foreign correspondent films were all in black and white. Tachyon would like to think that he shares Hartman's lack of prejudice toward Jokers, but that's not strictly true. He labors unceasingly in his clinic, and one cannot doubt that he cares, and cares deeply. Many Jokers think of him as a saint, a hero. Yet, when one has known the doctor as long as I have, deeper truths become apparent. On some unspoken level, he thinks of his good works in Jokertown as a penance. He does his best to hide it, but even after all these years, you can see the revulsion in his eyes. Dr. Tachyon and I are friends. We've known each other for decades now, and I believe with all my heart that he sincerely cares for me. But not for a second have I ever felt that he considers me an equal, as Hartman does. The senator treats me like a man, even an important man, courting me as he might any political leader with votes to deliver. To Dr. Tachyon, I will always be a joker. Is that his tragedy or mine? Tachyon knows nothing of the cancer, a symptom that our friendship is as diseased as my body. Perhaps. He has not been my personal physician for many years now. My doctor is a joker, as are my accountant, my attorney, my broker, and even my banker. The world has changed since the chase dismissed me, and as mayor of Jokertown, I'm obliged to practice my own personal brand of affirmative action. We have just been cleared for takeoff. The seat hopping is over. People are belting themselves in. It seems I carry Jokertown with me wherever I go. Howard Mueller sits closest to me, his seat customized to accommodate his 9-foot-tall form and the immense length of his arms. He's better known as Troll, and he works as chief of security at Tachyon's clinic, but I note that he does not sit with Tachyon among the aces. The other three Joker delegates, Father Squid, Chrysalis, and the poet Dorian Wilde, are also here in the center section of first class. Is it coincidence, prejudice, or shame that puts us here, in the seats furthest from the windows? Being a Joker makes one a tad paranoid about these things, I fear. The politicians of both the domestic and UN varieties have clustered to our right. The aces forward of us, aces up front, of course, and to our left. Must stop now. The stewardess has asked me to put my tray table back up. Airborne. New York and Robert Tumlin International Airport are far behind us, and Cuba waits ahead. From what I've heard, it'll be an easy and pleasant first stop. Havana is almost as American as Las Vegas or Miami Beach, albeit considerably more decadent and wicked. I may actually have friends there. Some of the top Joker entertainers go on to the Havana casinos after getting their starts in the Funhouse and the Chaos Club. I must remind myself to stay away from the gaming tables, however. Joker luck is notoriously bad. As soon as the seatbelt sign went off, a number of the aces ascended to the first-class lounge. I can hear their laughter drifting down the spiral stairway. Peregrine, pretty young Mistral who looks just like the college student she is when not in her flying gear. Boisterous Hiram Worcester, and Asta Lenzer, the ballerina from the ABT, whose ace name is Fantasy. Already they're a tight little clique, a fun bunch for whom nothing could possibly go wrong. The golden people, and Tachyon very much in their midst. Is it the aces or the women that draw him? I wonder. Even my dear friend Angela, who still loves the man deeply after 20-odd years, admits that Dr. Tachyon thinks mainly with his penis where women are concerned. Yet even among the aces, there are the odd men out. Jones, the black strongman from Harlem, like Troll and Hiram W. and Peregrine, he requires a custom seat, in his case to support his extraordinary weight, is nursing a beer and reading a copy of Sports Illustrated. Rod O'Reilly is just a solitary, gazing out the window. She seems very quiet. Billy Ray and Joanne Jefferson, the two Justice Department aces who head up our security contingent, are not delegates and thus are seated back in the second section. And then there's Jack Braun. The tensions that swirl around him are almost palpable. Most of the other delegates are polite to him, but no one is truly friendly, and he's being openly shunned by some, such as Hiram Worcester. For Dr. Tachyon, clearly, Braun does not even exist. I wonder whose idea it was to bring him on this trip, certainly not Tachyon's, and seems too politically dangerous for Hartman to be responsible. A gesture to appease the conservatives on scare, perhaps? Or are there ramifications that I have not considered? Braun glances up at the stairway from time to time, as if he would love nothing so much as to join the happy group upstairs, but remains firmly in his seat. It's hard to credit that this smooth-faced, blonde-haired boy in the tailored safari jacket is really the notorious Judas Ace of the 50s. He's my age, or close to it, but he looks barely 20. The kind of boy who might have taken pretty young Mistral to her senior prom a few years back and gotten her home well before midnight. One of the reporters, a man named Downs from Aces Magazine, was up here earlier, trying to get Braun to consent to an interview. He was persistent, but Braun's refusal was firm, and Downs finally gave up. Instead, he handed out copies of the latest issue of Aces and then sauntered up to the lounge, no doubt to pester someone else. I am not a regular reader of Aces, but I accepted a copy and suggested to Downs that his publisher consider a companion periodical to be called Jokers. He was not overly enthused about the idea. The issue features a rather striking cover photograph of the turtle shell outlined against the oranges and reds of sunset, blurbed with, "The Turtle, Dead or Alive." The turtle has not been seen since Wildcard Day back in September, when he was napalmed and crashed into the Hudson. Twisted and burnt pieces of his shell were found on the riverbed, though no body has ever been recovered. Several hundred people claimed to have seen the turtle near dawn the following day, flying an older shell in the sky over Jokertown, but since he has not reappeared since, some are putting that sighting down to hysteria and wishful thinking. I have no opinion on the turtle, though I would hate to think that he was truly dead. Many Jokers believe that he is one of us, that his shell conceals some unspeakable Joker deformity. Whether that is true or not, he has been a good friend to Jokertown for a long, long time. There is, however, an aspect to this trip that no one ever speaks of, although Downs's article brings it to mind. Perhaps it falls to me to mention the unmentionable, then. The truth is, all that laughter up in the lounge has a slightly nervous ring to it, and it is no coincidence that this junket, under discussion for so many years, was put together so swiftly in the past 2 months. They want us to get out of town for a while. Not just the Jokers, the Aces, too. The Aces, especially, one might even say. This last Wildcard Day was a catastrophe for the city and for every victim of the virus everywhere. The level of violence was shocking and made headlines across the nation. The still unsolved murder of the Howler, the dismemberment of a child Ace in the midst of a huge crowd at Jet Boy's tomb, the attack on Ace's High, the destruction of the turtle, or at least his shell, the wholesale slaughter at the cloisters, where a dozen bodies were brought out in pieces, the pre-dawn aerial battle that lit up the entire east side. Days, and even weeks later, the authorities were still not certain that they had an accurate death toll. One old man was found literally embedded in a solid brick wall, and when they began to chip him out, they found they could not tell where his flesh ended and the wall began. The autopsy revealed a ghastly mess inside, where his internal organs were fused with the bricks that penetrated them. A Post photographer snapped a picture of that old man trapped in his wall. He looked so gentle and sweet. The police subsequently announced that the old man was an Ace himself and, moreover, a notorious criminal, that he was responsible for the murders of Kid Dinosaur and the Howler, the attempted murder of the Turtle, the attack on Ace's High, the battle over the East River, the ghastly blood rites performed at the cloisters, and a whole range of lesser crimes. A number of Aces came forward to support this explanation, but the public does not seem convinced. According to the polls, more people believe the conspiracy theory put forward in the National Informer, that the killings were independent, caused by powerful Aces known and unknown, carrying out personal vendettas, using their powers in utter disregard for law and public safety, and that afterward, those Aces conspired with each other and the police to cover up their atrocities, blaming everything on one crippled old man, who happened to be conveniently dead, clearly at the hands of some Ace. Already several books have been announced, each purporting to explain what really happened. The immoral opportunism of the publishing industry knows no bounds. Koch, ever aware of the prevailing winds, has ordered several cases reopened and has instructed the IAD to investigate the police role. Jokers are pitiful and loathed. Aces have great power, and for the first time in many years, a sizable segment of the public has begun to distrust those aces and fear that power. No wonder that demagogues like Leo Barnett have swelled so vastly in the public mind of late. So, I'm convinced that our tour has a hidden agenda. To wash away the blood with some good ink, as they say, to diffuse the fear, to win back trust, and take everyone's mind off Wildcard Day. I admit to mixed feelings about aces, some of whom definitely do abuse their power. Nonetheless, as a joker, I find myself desperately hoping that we succeed, and desperately fearing the consequences if we do not.
Beasts of Burden by John J. Miller. Read for you by Selma Blair and Nicholas Guy Smith. From envy, hatred, and malice, and all uncharitableness, good Lord, deliver us. The Litany, Book of Common Prayer. His rudimentary sexual organs were dysfunctional, but his mounts thought of him as masculine, perhaps because his stunted, wasted body looked more male than female. What he thought of himself was an unopened book. He never communicated about matters of that sort. He had no name but that borrowed from folklore and given to him by his mounts, Tay Malice, and he didn't really care what they called him as long as they addressed him with respect. He liked the dark because his weak eyes were unduly sensitive to light. He never ate because he had no teeth to chew or tongue to taste. He never drank alcohol because the primitive sac that was his stomach couldn't digest it. Sex was out of the question. But he still enjoyed gourmet foods and vintage wines and expensive liquors and all possible varieties of sexual experience. He had his mounts. And he always was looking for more.
1. Chrysalis lived in the Jokertown slum where she owned a bar, so she was accustomed to viewing scenes of poverty and misery. But Jokertown was a slum in the most affluent country on the earth, and Balas, the slum district of Port-au-Prince, Haiti's sprawling waterfront capital city, was in one of the poorest. From the outside, the hospital looked like a set from a B-grade horror movie about an 18th-century insane asylum. The wall around it was crumbling stone, the sidewalk leading to it was rotting concrete, and the building itself was filthy from years of accumulated bird shit and grime. Inside, it was worse. The walls were abstract designs of peeling paint and mildew. The bare wooden floors creaked ominously, and once, Mordecai Jones, the 450-pound ace called the Harlem Hammer, stepped on a section that gave way. He would have fallen all the way through the floor if an alert Hiram Worcester hadn't quickly relieved him of 9/10 of his weight. The smell clinging to the corridors was indescribable, but was mostly compounded of the various odors of death. But the very worst, thought Chrysalis, were the patients, especially the children. They lay uncomplainingly on filthy bare mattresses that reeked of sweat, urine, and mildew, their bodies racked by diseases banished long ago in America and wasted by the bloat of malnutrition. They watched their visitors troop by without curiosity or comprehension, serene hopelessness filling their eyes. It was better being a joker, she thought, though she loathed what the wildcard virus had done to her once beautiful body. Chrysalis couldn't stand any more of the unrelievable suffering. She left the hospital after passing through the first ward and returned to the waiting motorcade. The driver of the jeep she'd been assigned to looked at her curiously, but said nothing. He hummed a happy little tune while they waited for the others, occasionally singing a few off-key phrases in Haitian Creole. The tropical sun was hot. Chrysalis, bundled in an all-enveloping hood and cloak to protect her delicate flesh and skin from the sun's burning rays, watched a group of children playing across the street from the rundown hospital. Sweat trickling in tickling rivulets down her back, she almost envied the children in the cool freedom of their near nakedness. They seemed to be fishing for something in the depths of the storm drain that ran under the street. It took Chrysalis a moment to realize what they were doing, but when she did, all thoughts of envy disappeared. They were drawing water out of the drain and pouring it into battered, rusty pots and cans. Sometimes they stopped to drink a mouthful. She looked away, wondering if joining Tachyon's little traveling show had been a mistake. It had sounded like a good idea when Tachyon had invited her. It was, after all, an opportunity to travel around the world at government expense while rubbing shoulders with a variety of important and influential people. There was no telling what interesting tidbits of information she would be able to pick up. It had seemed like such a good idea at the time. "Well, my dear, if I hadn't actually seen it with my own eyes, I'd say you hadn't the stomach for this sort of thing." She smiled mirthlessly as Dorian Wilde heaved himself into the back seat of the jeep next to her. She wasn't in the mood for the poet's famous wit. "I certainly wasn't expecting treatment like this," she said in her cultured British accent, as Dr. Tachyon, Senator Hartman, Hiram Worcester, and other important and influential politicians and aces streamed toward the limos waiting for them, while Chrysalis, Wilde, and the other obvious jokers on the tour had to make do with the dirty, dented jeeps clustered at the rear of the cavalcade. "You should have," Wilde said. He was a large man whose delicate features were losing their handsomeness to bloat. He wore an Edwardian outfit that was in desperate need of cleaning and pressing, and enough floral-scented body wash to make Chrysalis glad that they were in an open vehicle. He waved his left hand languorously as he talked and kept his right in the pocket of his jacket. "Jokers, after all, are the niggers of the world." He pursed his lips and glanced at their driver, who, like 95% of Haiti's population, was black. "A statement not without irony on this island." Chrysalis grabbed the back of the driver's seat as the jeep jounced away from the curb, following the rest of the cavalcade as it pulled away from the hospital. The air was cool against Chrysalis's face, hidden deep within the folds of her hood, but the rest of her body was drenched with sweat. She fantasized about a long, cool drink and a slow, cool bath for the hour it took the motorcade to wend its way through Port-au-Prince's narrow, twisting streets. When they finally reached the Royal Haitian Hotel, she stepped down into the street almost before the jeep stopped, anxious for the waiting coolness of the lobby, and was instantly engulfed by a sea of beseeching faces, all babbling in Haitian Creole. She couldn't understand what the beggars were saying, but she didn't have to speak their language to understand the want and desperation in their eyes, tattered clothing and brittle, emaciated bodies. The press of imploring beggars pinned her against the side of the jeep, and the immediate rush of pity she'd felt for their obvious need was submerged in fear, fueled by their piteously beseeching voices and the dozens of thin, stick-like arms thrust out at her. The driver, before she could say or do anything, reached under the jeep's dashboard and grabbed a long, thin wooden rod that looked like a truncated broomstick, stood up and began swinging it at the beggars while shouting rapid, harsh phrases in Creole. Chrysalis heard and saw the skinny arm of a young boy snap at the first blow. The second opened the scalp of an old man, and the third missed as the intended victim managed to duck away. The driver drew the weapon back to strike again. Chrysalis, her usually cautious reserve, overcome by sudden outrage, turned to him and screamed, "Stop! Stop that!" And with the sudden movement, the hood fell away from her face, revealing her features for the first time. Revealing, that is, what features she had. Her skin and flesh were as clear as the finest blown glass, without flaw or bubble. Besides the muscles that clung to her skull and jaw, only the meat of her lips was visible. They were dark red pads on the gleaming expanse of her skull. Her eyes, floating in the depth of their naked sockets, were as blue as fragments of sky. The driver gaped at her. The beggars, whose importunings had turned to wails of fear, all fell silent at once, as if an invisible octopus had simultaneously slapped a tentacle over each one's mouth. The silence dragged on for a half dozen heartbeats, and then one of the beggars whispered a name in a soft, odd voice.
Madame Brigitte.
It passed among the beggars like a whispered invocation, until even those who had crowded around the other vehicles in the motorcade were craning their necks to get a glimpse of her. She pressed back against the jeep. The concentrated stares of the beggars mixed fear and awe and wonder, frightening her. The tableau held for another moment until the driver spoke a harsh phrase and gestured with his stick. The crowd dispersed at once, but not, however, without some of the beggars shooting Chrysalis final glances of mingled awe and dread. Chrysalis turned to the driver. He was a tall, thin black in a cheap, ill-fitting blue serge suit and an open-neck shirt. He looked back at her sullenly, but Chrysalis couldn't really read his expression because of the dark sunglasses he wore. "Do you speak English?" she asked him.
"Oui, a little."
Chrysalis could hear the harsh edge of fear in his voice, and she wondered what put it there. "Why did you strike them?" He shrugged. "These beggars are peasants. Scum from the country come to Port-au-Prince to beg on the generousness of people as yourself. I tell them to go."
"Speak loudly and carry a big stick," Wilde said sardonically from his seat in the back of the jeep.
Chrysalis glared at him. "You are a big help." He yawned. "I make it a habit never to brawl in the streets. It's so vulgar." Chrysalis snorted, turned back to the driver.
"Who," she asked, "is Madame Brigitte?"
The driver shrugged in a particularly Gallic manner, illustrating again the cultural ties Haiti had to the country from which she'd been politically independent for nearly 200 years. "She is Aloa, the wife of Baron Somedy."
"Baron Somedy?"
"A most powerful Loa. He is the lord and guardian of the cemetery, the keeper of the crossroads."
"What's Aloa?"
He frowned, shrugged almost angrily.
"Aloa is a spirit, a part of God, very powerful and divine."
"And I resemble this Madame Brigitte."
He said nothing, but continued to stare at her from behind his dark glasses, and despite the afternoon's tropical heat, Chrysalis felt a shiver run down her spine. She felt naked despite the voluminous cloak she wore. It wasn't a bodily nakedness. She was, in fact, accustomed to going half-naked in public as a private, obscene gesture to the world, making sure that everyone saw what she had to see every time she looked in a mirror. It was a spiritual nakedness that she felt, as if everyone who was staring at her was trying to discover who she was trying to divine the precious secrets that were the only masks that she had. She felt a desperate need to get away from all the staring eyes, but she wouldn't let herself run from them. It took all her nerve, all the cool she could muster, but she managed to walk into the hotel lobby with precise, measured steps. Inside, it was cool and dark. Chrysalis leaned against a high-backed chair that looked as if it had been made sometime in the last century and dusted sometime in the last decade. She took a deep, calming breath and let it out slowly.
"What was that all about?"
She looked over her shoulder to see Peregrine regarding her with concern. The winged woman had been in one of the limos at the head of the parade, but she'd obviously seen the byplay that had centered around Chrysalis's jeep. Peregrine's beautiful satin-feathered wings only added a touch of the exotic to her lithe, tanned sensuality.
She should be easy to resent, Chrysalis thought. Her affliction had brought her fame, notoriety, even her own television show. But she looked genuinely concerned, genuinely worried, and Chrysalis felt in need of sympathetic company. But she couldn't explain something to Peregrine that she only half understood herself. She shrugged. Nothing. She looked around the lobby that was rapidly filling with tour personnel. I could use a few moments of peace and quiet, and a drink. So could I, a masculine voice announced before Peregrine could speak. Let's find the bar and I'll tell you some of the facts of Haitian life. Both women turned to look at the man who'd spoken. He was 6 feet tall, give or take, and strongly built. He wore a suit of white tropical weight linen that was immaculately clean and sharply creased. There was something odd about his face. His features didn't quite match. His chin was too long, his nose too broad. His eyes were misaligned and too bright. Chrysalis knew him only by reputation. He was a Justice Department ace, part of the security contingent Washington had assigned to Tachyon's tour. His name was Billy Ray. Some wit at JD with a classical education had tagged him with the nickname Carnifex. He liked it. He was an authentic badass. What do you mean? Chrysalis asked. Ray looked around the lobby, his lips quirking. Let's find the bar and talk things over. Privately. Chrysalis glanced at Peregrine, and the winged woman read the appeal in her eyes. Mind if I tag along? She asked. Hey, not at all. Ray frankly admired her lithe, tanned form, and the black and white striped sundress that showed it off. He licked his lips as Chrysalis and Peregrine exchanged unbelieving glances. The hotel lounge was doing desultory afternoon business. They found an empty table surrounded by other empty tables and gave their orders to a red-uniformed waiter who couldn't decide whom to stare at, Peregrine or Chrysalis. They sat in silence until he'd returned with the drinks, and Chrysalis drank down the thimbleful of amaretto that he'd brought. The travel brochures all said that Haiti's supposed to be a bloody tropical paradise, she said in a tone that indicated she felt the brochures all lied. I'll take you to paradise, babe, Ray said. Chrysalis liked it when men paid attention to her, sometimes too much. Sometimes, she realized, she conducted her affairs for all the wrong reasons. Even Brennan, yeoman, she reminded herself, yeoman. She had to remember that she wasn't supposed to know his real name. Had become her lover because she'd forced herself on him. It was, she supposed, the sense of power that she liked, the control she had when she made men come to her. But making men make love to her body was also, she recognized, with her habit of relentless self-scrutiny, another way to punish a revulsed world. But Brennan, yeoman, damn it, had never been revulsed. He had never made her turn out the lights before kissing her. And he had always made love with his eyes open and watching her heartbeat, her lungs bellow, her breath catch behind tightly clenched teeth. Ray's foot moved under the table, touching hers, drawing her back from the thoughts of the past, of what was over. She smiled a lazy smile at him, gleaming teeth set in a gleaming skull. There was something about Ray that was unsettling. He talked too loud, he smiled too much, and some part of him, his hands or his feet or his mouth, was always in motion. He had a reputation for violence. Not that she had anything against violence, as long as it wasn't directed at her. For goodness sake, even she'd lost track of all the men yeomen had sent to the reward since his arrival in the city. But paradoxically, Brennan wasn't a violent man. Ray, according to his reputation, had a habit of running amok. Compared to Brennan, he was a self-centered bore. She wondered if she'd be comparing all the men she would know to her archer. And she felt a rush of annoyance and regret. I doubt that you'd have the skill to transport me to the dreariest shithole in the poorest part of Jokertown, dear boy, let alone paradise. Peregrine squelched a twitchy smile and looked away. Chrysalis felt Billy's foot move away as he fixed her with a hard, dangerous stare. He was about to say something vicious when Dr. Tachyon interrupted by flopping into the empty chair next to Peregrine. Ray shot Chrysalis a look that told her the remark wouldn't be forgotten.
My dear. Takian bowed over Peregrine's hand, kissed it, and nodded greetings to everyone else. It was common knowledge that he was hot over the glamorous flyer. But then, Chrysalis reflected, most men were. Takian, however, was self-confident enough to be determined in his pursuit, and thick-headed enough not to call it off, even after numerous polite rebuffs on Peregrine's part. How is the meeting with Dr. Tessier? Peregrine asked, removing her hand delicately from Tachyon's grasp when he showed no inclination of letting it go on his own. Tachyon frowned, whether in disappointment at Peregrine's continuing coolness or in remembrance of his visit to the Haitian hospital. Chrysalis couldn't tell. Dreadful, he murmured. Simply dreadful. He caught the eye of a waiter and gestured him over. Bring me something cool, with lots of rum in it. He looked around the table. Anyone else? Chrysalis tinged a red-painted fingernail. It looked like a rose petal floating on bone against her empty cordial glass. Yes, and more, amaretto. Amaretto for the lady there. The waiter sidled up to Chrysalis and slipped the glass out from in front of her without making eye contact. She could feel his fear. It was funny, in a way, that someone could be afraid of her. But it angered her as well, almost as much as the guilt in Tachyon's eyes every time he looked at her. Tachyon ran his fingers dramatically through his long, curly red hair. There wasn't much incidence of wild card virus that I could see. He fell silent, sighed gustily. And Tessier himself wasn't overly concerned about it. But everything else, by the ideal, everything else. What do you mean? Peregrine asked. You were there. That hospital was as crowded as a Jokertown bar on Saturday night and about as sanitary. Typhus patients were cheek to jowl with tuberculosis patients, and elephantiasis patients and AIDS patients, and patients suffering from 50 other diseases that have been eradicated everywhere else in the civilized world. As I was having a private chat with the hospital administrator, the electricity went out twice. I tried to call the hotel, but the phones weren't working. Dr. Tessier told me that they're low on blood, antibiotics, painkillers, and just about all medicinals. Fortunately, Tessier and many of the other doctors are masters at utilizing the medicinal properties of native Haitian flora. Tessier showed me a thing or two he's done with distillations from common weeds and such that was remarkable. In fact, someone should write an article on the drugs they've concocted. Some of their discoveries deserve widespread attention in the outside world, but for all their efforts, all their dedication, they're still losing the fight. The waiter brought Tachyon's drink in a tall, slim glass garnished with slices of fresh fruit and a paper umbrella. Tachyon threw out the fruit and paper umbrella and swallowed half his drink in a single gulp. I have never seen such misery and suffering. Welcome to the third world, Ray said. Indeed. Tachyon finished off his drink and fixed Chrysalis with his lilac-colored eyes. Now, what was that disturbance in front of the hotel? Chrysalis shrugged. The driver started beating the beggars with a stick. A coco macaque. I beg your pardon? Tachyon said, turning to Ray. It's called a coco macaque. It's a walking stick, polished with oil, hard as an iron bar, a real nasty weapon. There was approval in Ray's voice. The Tonton Macaque carry them. What? Three voices asked simultaneously. Ray smiled a smile of superior knowledge. Tonton Macaque, that's what the peasants call them. Essentially means boogeyman. Officially, they're called the VSN, the Volontaires de la Sécurité Nationale. Ray had an atrocious accent. They're Duvalier's secret police, headed by a man named Charlemagne Calixte. He's black as a coal mine at midnight and ugly as sin. Somebody tried to poison him once. He lived through it, but it scarred his face terribly. He's the only reason Baby Doc's still in power. Duvalier has his secret police acting as our chauffeurs? Tachyon asked, astonished. Whatever for? Ray looked at him as if he were a child. So they can watch us,
They watch everybody. It's their job. Ray laughed a sudden, barking laugh. They're easy enough to spot. They all have dark sunglasses and wear blue suits, sort of a badge of office. There's one over there. Ray gestured to the far corner of the lounge. The Tonton Macoute sat at an otherwise empty table, a bottle of rum and half-filled glass in front of him. Even though the lounge was dimly lit, he had on dark glasses, and his blue suit was as unkempt as any of Dorian Wilde's. "I'll see about this," Tachyon said, outrage in his voice. He started to stand, but settled back in his chair as a large, scowling man came into the lounge and strode straight toward their table. "It's him," Ray whispered. "Charlemagne Calixte."